Anne Jung, ich bin Gesundheitsreferentin beim Medico und werde das erste Panel mit Ihnen, werde das heute moderieren. Ja, wir haben die Zahlen nochmal nachgeschaut gestern mit 23.694 Erkrankten und bislang 9.500 bestätigten Todesfällen übertrifft die derzeitige Ebola-Epidemie alle bisherigen Ausbrüche. Anlass genug, sich mit den Ursachen für die Epidemie zu befassen. Im Titel unseres Workshops, das Programm für den ganzen Tag, finden Sie auch noch mal vorne im Eingangsbereich. Das können Sie sich gerne auch noch mal mitnehmen, um zu sehen, was Sie heute erwartet. Haben wir absichtlich Ebola nicht genannt. Wir wollen zeigen, und damit werden sich auch viele unserer Referenten heute befassen, dass es eben um mehr geht als nur um Ebola und auch, dass Ebola eben mehr ist als nur eine Krankheit. Wir werden heute den Bogen spannen von den politischen, den sozialen und wirtschaftlichen Ursachen von Epidemien über den Umgang, den konkreten Umgang mit der Ebola-Epidemie am Beispiel der Länder, vor allen Dingen Liberia und Sierra Leone. Auch im Kontext von Hilfskonzepten. Wir werden sprechen über Sicherheitspolitiken und wir werden uns in unserer Abschlussdebatte befassen mit der Bekämpfung der strukturellen Ursachen, die wir dort in den Blick nehmen möchten. Die Referentinnen und Referenten werden wir Ihnen jeweils zum Beginn der einzelnen Panel vorstellen. Ich muss Ihnen aber eine Programmänderung bekannt geben. Der Herr Lindner, der Sonderbotschafter der Bundesregierung für Ebola, ist leider gestern nach Liberia gereist und wird heute nicht kommen können. Allerdings freuen wir uns, dass so kurzfristig Daniela Vogel einspringen konnte. Sie ist seine engste Mitarbeiterin und wird dann heute Nachmittag die Seite der Regierung vertreten. Aber nun möchte ich Ihnen gerne unser heutiges Eingangspanel vorstellen und möchte beginnen zu meiner Rechten mit Abu Breimer. Um ihn vorzustellen, möchte ich mit einem Satz den kamerunischen Philosophen Achil Mbembe zitieren. Er äußerte kurz nach dem Beginn der Epidemie die Sorge, dass der afrikanische Kontinent durch die Ebola-Epidemie nun im zweifachen Sinne aufs Neue eingesperrt werden könnte. Im Inneren durch die Schließung der Grenzen zwischen den afrikanischen Staaten und nach außen, damit Afrikanerinnen und Afrikaner nicht die Grenzen nach Europa überqueren können, egal ob als Flüchtlinge, als Studierende, als Unternehmerinnen, als Migrantinnen oder eben als Referenten. Und dass diese Befürchtungen sich bewahrheitet haben, zeigt die wirklich sehr mühsame Anreise unseres ersten Referenten am heutigen Tage. Er musste schon alleine 4.000 Kilometer zurücklegen, um überhaupt ein Visum zu bekommen. Er musste eine Woche in Accra verbringen, um dort die Formalitäten zu erledigen. Und die Kosten, die nötig waren, um ihn hierher zu holen, würden in etwa ausreichen, um das Überleben einer Familie in Sierra Leone für ein ganzes Jahr zu sichern. Deswegen möchte ich ihn jetzt ganz besonders herzlich hier begrüßen. Ich bin sehr froh, dass das geklappt hat. Abu Breimer ist Menschenrechtler. Er studierte zuvor Agrarwissenschaften in Sierra Leone, in Ghana und Kanada. Er war nach seinem Studium als Bildungskoordinator bei der katholischen Kirche tätig und hat dann schon im Jahr 1988 die Organisation Network Movement for Justice and Development gegründet, eine Organisation, mit der Medico schon seit den späten 90er Jahren zusammenarbeitet und die sich für eine gerechte Verteilung der Ressourcen und für nachhaltige Entwicklung einsetzt. Ganz außen sitzt Frau Dr. Gisela Schneider. Sie ist Direktorin von DIFEM, vielen wahrscheinlich bei Ihnen bekannt, dem Deutschen Institut für ärztliche Mission. Sie ist spezialisiert in Tropenmedizin und öffentlicher Gesundheit. Lange Jahre hat sie in Gambia gearbeitet, sowohl im klinischen Bereich mit den Schwerpunkten HIV und AIDS und Frauengesundheit, aber auch in der Basisgesundheitsarbeit. Sie war auch in den letzten Monaten seit Ausbruch der Ebola-Epidemie immer wieder in den betroffenen Ländern und kann also von dort sehr gut berichten. Schließen werden wir heute, und Sie haben gesehen, dass die Reihenfolge etwas anders ist als im Programmheft geplant. Das kommt dann daher, wenn man zusammen noch frühstückt im Hotel und dann nochmal alles bespricht und dann doch denkt, nein, wir machen es doch in einer anderen Weise. Also Dr. David McCoy wird dann heute der dritte Panelist sein. Er ist auch Arzt und er wird sich dann mit der sozialen Pathologie der Epidemie befassen. David arbeitet am Center for Primary Care and Public Health an der Queen Mary University in London. Er war viele Jahre lang Forschungsdirektor für den Public Health Systems Trust, einer NGO zur Unterstützung der Post-Apartheid-Transformation des südafrikanischen Gesundheitssystems. Und er engagiert sich im People's Health Movement, einem globalen Gesundheitsnetzwerk, dem auch Medico angehört. Und ich kenne ja so ein paar Gesichter hier unter Ihnen. Wir haben ja immer wieder in den letzten Jahren auch Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten des People's Health Movement eingeladen. Und ich möchte dann noch kurz darauf hinweisen, dass der neue Global Health Watch, der für Sie vielleicht von Interesse ist, jetzt gerade erschienen ist, an dem David McCoy auch mitgearbeitet hat. Und wenn Sie das interessiert, können Sie dann gerne nach der Veranstaltung nochmal zu mir kommen. So viel der Vorrede. Jetzt starten wir und Abu, du hast das Wort. Herzlich willkommen.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you everybody for the warm welcome. I think what Anne did not say is that in spite of the hiccups and all the challenges posed, I was able to come, and I'm here. Which may contrast with other countries that I will name later on in my presentation. I would also, like Anne, would like to start by, you know, a quotation from Margaret Chan of the World Health Organization, when on the 26th of September, she said that Ebola epidemic ravaging parts of West Africa is the most severe acute public health emergency seen in modern times. Never before in recorded history has a biosafety level 4 pathogen infected so many people so quickly over such a broad geographical area for so long, unquote. So you can probably figure out the seriousness of this disease. Of course, the health people, specialists, will come to the details of that. But what she was talking about was about three countries south of the Sahara in the Mano River Union zone of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And these countries, fortunately, are very heavily forested. They have rich, abundant natural resources, and they are a place that everyone would like to go. But these same countries, two of them have had a very unfortunate experience of going through more than a decade of brutal civil war, where all their economies, all their infrastructure were completely devastated and destroyed, and many of their people were living in disarray. These same countries share very common human development indicators. In fact, it is, to my mind, not an accident that the poorest, being the poorest countries under the sun, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, the number 175, 179, and 183, respectively, out of 187 countries on the Human Development Index 2013. So they are just at the very bottom. The health systems of these countries were completely ineffective and almost non-existent. And according to the World Bank, health expenditures per person in Sierra Leone, for instance, was about 26 cents a day at market exchange rates. And there were, at the outbreak of the Ebola disease, there were only 120 doctors, medical doctors, for 6 million people in Sierra Leone. That means that there were 50,000 people to one doctor. I don't know how that any doctor will manage that. You see, the poor countries, but these same poor countries, Sierra Leone and Liberia, also have very well-trained medical doctors. But more of these doctors work in OECD countries than in their own countries. So they may be subsidizing, you know, the health situation in OECD countries. Now, the question of Ebola is very serious. It goes beyond health. But it will be important to know some of the indicators of the context of these countries. Before the Ebola crisis hit, some 45% of children under 5 were stunted in Sierra Leone. That is a low height for age. And 1 in 5 were wasted. That is low weight for age. So, moreover, Sierra Leone was also seen to hold 4 appalling world records, according to World Bank statistics in 2013. Sierra Leone had the lowest life expectancy in the world, 45 years for men and 46 years for women. It also had the worst child under 5 mortality rate in the world, with 1 in 6 children dying before reaching the age of 5. It also had the highest maternal mortality rate in the world, with 1 in 9 women dying in labor. So, can you imagine that if a country is having those kind of world health records from preventable diseases like, you know, like malaria, tuberculosis, pneumonia, or typhoid, how would it cope with a serious disease like Ebola, which they will tell you more about? And this has not been so because of the singular irresponsibility, I would say, of the countries that are involved, but also it has to do with global response, how the global community has responded to the issue of the Ebola. And as my brother Achille mentioned, like Anne quoted, I would describe it as a case of neglect, discrimination, exclusion, and isolation. The failure of these countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, to deal with the issue of Ebola is compounded by the health policy failure at multilateral level at various stages in the development efforts of these countries. For instance, when the war ended in Sierra Leone and Liberia, that would have been an opportunity to overhaul the entire health system in those countries so that the international community can support those countries to set up their health systems like they have in the developed world. But it didn't work. When the Ebola started, they could have snuffed this Ebola right at the outset where the Ebola was concentrated, like in Gekedu, which is the forest region, where Gekedu and Kailan and Lofa County, they met. And that was the zone where, you know, that Ebola was found. They could have really dealt with it right from there if they wanted to. And I'm sure they had all the capacity and means to do that. Of course, the worst things that I would imagine is happening as a result of the Ebola, I'm sure some of you have read the Bible. It's like the case of the biblical leprosy. The biblical leprosy, when people had leprosy in the times of Jesus, everybody avoided them. They were isolated. They were outcast. They were put in a separate zone. Nobody was. And they were declared not only unclean, but they were also considered to have been caused by God. So therefore, they had to be set aside. And that was what happened to Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. What I will call protectionism from the world. So the specter of Ebola protectionism prevailed. As the Ebola virus disease ravages our countries, there were increasing measures by several Western countries or governments of the world who have been the same development partners to these same countries to prevent people from these countries from interacting with the rest of the world. These protectionist measures range from strict exit and entry controls, such as temperature checks and mandatory monitoring or quarantine of travelers for 21 days or even less sometimes from MRU states, but also from the banning of flights. For instance, you know, I cannot imagine that Britain will stop British Airways flight from going to Sierra Leone being the country that was colonized by Britain. But it was the first airline that stopped going to Sierra Leone. Same followed by Air France, and of course, Air France had close relationship with Guinea, and also Kenya Airways, and so on. But quite apart from that, there were also deniers of visas. I mean, I said, you know, at least the German government, of course, they have increased the cost of their visa to over 2,000 euro, but at least they are able to allow me to come. So, but Canada, for instance, or Australia, will not allow. In fact, last week when I was in Ghana, I went to Canadian embassy because I have to go there in April, and I was told by the agency there, IOM, that they have been instructed not to accept any application from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. So I said, who said? He said, the government. I said, let me have the paper that shows that. He said, it's an instruction. I said, I will not take no for an answer. Because I don't understand how Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea can, you know, suddenly be extricated from this world and be considered not part of the international community. So it is as bad as that. If this phenomenon of Ebola protectionism is allowed to take root in the global public policy, the effect on the countries, the diaspora citizens, and such states, and Africa in general, will be really catastrophic. It has the potential to undermine, you know, the fight to tackle the disease at its source. It makes also a mockery of the multilateral system of cooperation and international development policy, and ultimately, it will transform the Ebola epidemic into a pandemic. And I don't think that Germany will allow that to happen. And this type of protectionism actually is also driven by economic interests. You know, it can also fear capital flight, it can undermine trade, it can even cause and awaken xenophobic and racial attitudes and practices, you know, as being experienced in Western countries, where children or students from Ebola countries are being denied certain facilities. For instance, the Time magazine on the 28th of October, 2014, reported two children from Senegal. And Senegal is only a country that had, only one or two Ebola, and ever since has been declared safe by World Health Organization. And yet, children from these countries were faced with embarrassment and harassment when in school in New York, you know, they were beaten by their colleagues, you know, shouting, Ebola, Ebola, Ebola. You know. So that's the kind of thing. And many other citizens have been denied, you know, other facilities like house rents, like, you know, going to events or conferences. So there are a lot of problems that citizens are facing. Of course, we cannot blame the international community solely for this kind of problem because every state is an autonomy. They say territorial integrity, even though those territories are largely controlled by external forces than anything else. But some of the practical, critical issues that are happening on the ground in the countries themselves have to do first with the fact that these three countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, have woefully failed to pay sufficient attention to the development or building of institutions that can ensure citizens' trust in government policies. Governments in my country, for instance, Sierra Leone, is hardly present in the lives of most people for the most fundamental things such as jobs, social services, and social security. People invariably, therefore, fend for themselves and have learned to not depend or trust the word of government. So therefore, even as government gives instructions about the dangers of Ebola, they continue to ignore that especially when that is not accompanied by any provision of adequate health facilities or resources. They go about doing their own things anyway. So in a sense, Ebola crisis has helped to underscore the point that rampant informal coping strategies are an index on development that disconnects citizens from the state. So the practice again of our government of centralized form of governance without due regard and respect for local knowledge and local, experiences and expertise is also part of the problem. Most of the efforts at the beginning of the Ebola crisis were centralized in the cities, in the district headquarters towns. They set up the, health teams or the barrier teams in the district headquarters. When villages 20, 50, 70 miles away, when somebody dies, when you make a call, you can't get any response for 2-3 days. What do you expect the citizens to do? To leave their dead to rot? So people had to carry their dead and bury. And some of these things have been really difficult. People have not been consulted, they have not been involved in decisions, and they have not been asked about their opinions of what to do. And that's really part of the problem in my country. I'm sure the opposite was the case in Liberia at some stage, which helped to solve the problem. And we are still yet to reach that stage. Even more worrying also is the fact that the government is losing revenue to the mining sector. I mean, some of the mining companies that are mining in my country, as reported by we have a coalition of civil society organizations called Budget Advocacy Network, it revealed that government has been losing revenue consistently and constantly. For instance, from the customs duties and goods and services tax, government lost about $224 million in 2012, amounting to about 8.3% of the GDP. In 2011, the losses were even higher, about 13.7% of GDP. And the annual average over the 3 years, 2010 to 2012, was about $199 million per year. And that's strong, that is big enough for a country, for a poor country that relies on outsiders for their, for their survival and everything. So these tax expenditures could instead have been spent on improving health services. Yet in 2011, the government spent more on tax incentives than on all its development priorities, such as agriculture, roads, health, education, energy, water, and transport. And in 2012, the government spent nearly as much on tax incentive as its development priorities. In 2012, the tax expenditure alone amounted to an astonishing 59% of the entire government budget, which is about 8 times the health budget. And that is scandalous. You can't be asking and begging international community to support you while throwing your own money away and allowing corporate entities to come and just siphon your resources and go scot-free. What has been the impact of this? As the impact is at various levels. The Ebola has actually caused, not caused all of this problem, but it has awakened our consciousness, awareness of the real implications of poor development and poor governance in our countries, and actual international alliance for continuing to undermine the development of poor nations. And the impacts are at various levels. One is at the healthcare service. I'm sure they will talk more about that. But I cannot understand that the rest of the world has a lot of health, their health systems are set up, and those poor countries have never been prioritized, have never been assisted to set up their health systems very well. And yet, the international community allows the sons and daughters and wives and girlfriends of ministers to have their health checks done in developed countries. Schools, education, the children of all our development, our ministers and government personnel have their children in developed countries, in other countries, other than their own country, because they have facilitated the destruction of their own education system. Schools were closed down since the beginning of the Ebola pandemic in May or July last year, and until this day, schools have not been reopened, from kindergarten to university. So you can imagine what is going to happen in the near future. At the level of gender and women and children, you will come to realize, if you read about Ebola, that those who have suffered most in this Ebola crisis are women, because they are the caregivers. They are the ones that have to take responsibility, and as by extension, children. So the impact is great. So if, as we struggle to bring about gender equality, and yet these same people are the ones that are going to be suffering from such diseases, then we are very far from making any equality possible in our countries. And that is a serious issue for all of us. Of course, the elderly, the people with disabilities, are the ones that are also very seriously hit by this disease. Because people with disability, they beg on the streets, they rely on social contacts with their relatives and friends. And when Ebola struck, well, contacts were avoided and people will not be on the streets as they were. So those who rely on others to support them have no longer those people around. So they cannot. Beggars no longer able to beg because they cannot get what they want. So it makes life so difficult and so impossible. Famine, livelihoods become, the cost of living has increased, and people cannot survive because they lost all their farming season. They were not able to cultivate their farms because they needed labor from their friends, from their colleagues, to go and plow their farms. But because they cannot gather together and bring people to farm, they cannot. So the next seasons, or two or three, are going to be real hunger seasons, and people are going to be in trouble. It is evident from the above that the level of vulnerability and poverty has dramatically increased following the outbreak of the disease. More vulnerable and liable to suffer enduring hardships are women, orphan children, people with disabilities, and the active youth population. For this, it is certain that spending requirement towards social protection and has more than doubled relative to the epidemic crisis requirement. Under these circumstances, government needs to undertake strategic and careful political and economic decisions if the Ebola crisis is to end and if the hardships are to be overturned. The country already has less likely to meet the UN Millennium Development Goals. The Ebola crisis has even made it even harder, and it has compounded it. So this has made things difficult. So one would ask, is there any possibility, therefore? What would be the way forward? How do we want to see the situation, not only of Ebola, but the entire structure or the countries now? Well, there are a few things to look at. There are global responsibilities as well as national responsibilities, because Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are not isolated. They are not living in their own planet. They are living on this planet, and we have our German, British, our Canadian, or Australian, or South African companies that are mining and siphoning our resources from those countries. They have a responsibility. So what can the governments of these countries do to hold those companies accountable, to stop them from evading taxes, to make them sure that fair trade and just trade is done? And your governments have the responsibility to do that. They have to make sure that our countries do not remain forever to be begging. I mean, don't be surprised if Sierra Leoneans will move today and look for passports and visas as much as possible to escape Sierra Leone and come to Germany or anywhere else, because it is their right to also enjoy the fruits of their resources that have been taken away and stored or used to build and reach the countries. At the global level also, I think there is a need to cancel all debts, multilateral and bilateral debts. The IMF, recently they said they're going to give some concessions and then also give more loans. How will these countries pay any loans? The countries are already ravaged. They don't have anything to survive on. And then they will be giving and servicing the debt. It doesn't make sense. It's a perpetual attempt to keep those countries poor. There's also the need for the international community to consider the fact that health and education and food security are paramount. And therefore, grants need to be given and expertise to overhaul the systems in those countries. If, in order to stop restricting people from coming around. I see that when I come around, some people don't even want to stretch their hands and greet me because they fear that I might be carrying Ebola. But of course, I don't have it. If I had it, I would have been having, you know, the fever already. But these are attempts, you know, stigmatization. We need to stop that. At the local level, at national level, the governments need to do to be a bit more serious. We don't have governments that are in the interest, that have the interest of the people at heart. There's high level of corruption. There is complete sense of irresponsibility and total disregard for anything that is called democracy. And I think those countries' governments have to stand up. But how will they stand up? I think they have to be forced to stand up by citizens and civil society. So we would encourage our Western partners to support citizens' actions or civil societies that are working to educate and mobilize and organize citizens so that they can hold their leaders accountable. And that is the only way that, you know, governments can begin to show some sense of responsibility. Otherwise, I think it will be difficult, and your protectionist approaches and strategies will only work for a short while. Everything will collapse, and everybody will be in the same boat. I thank you very much.
Ja, vielen Dank an dich, Abu, dass du uns nochmal gezeigt hast, wie die durch die Ebola die tödlichen Folgen des politischen Umgangs mit diesen westafrikanischen Ländern und auch durch die ökonomische Ausbeutung das nochmal so in so einer dramatischen Weise potenziert wurde. Wir machen jetzt weiter mit dir, Gisela, und werden uns jetzt konzentrieren auf die Situation der Gesundheitsarbeiterinnen. Und bitte, du hast das Wort. Danke.
Ja, ganz herzlichen Dank für die Einladung. Und ich bin froh, dass Medico hier diesen Tag macht, um wirklich auch an den breiteren Zusammenhang von Ebola zu denken und zu reflektieren, wie wir diese Epidemie wirklich überwinden können. Ich selber war jetzt dreimal, ich war zweimal in Liberia und einmal in Sierra Leone, habe dort mit den christlichen Gesundheitsnetzwerken gearbeitet, oder wir arbeiten mit den christlichen Gesundheitsnetzwerken, und werde einiges aus dieser direkten Erfahrung berichten. Aber einfach noch einmal ganz kurz, es sind vielleicht nicht alle hier, die alle Zahlen im Kopf haben und das letzte halbe Jahr intensiv verfolgt haben. Hier ein kurzer Überblick über das, was ich in den nächsten 15 Minuten kurz präsentieren werde. Ebola hits the heart of the health system. Ich glaube, ich habe manchmal den Eindruck, es ist fast wie ein Erdbeben der Sozialstrukturen in diesen Ländern, und wir werden uns das jetzt besonders für das Gesundheitssystem anschauen. Hier diese drei Länder, und auf dieser Karte sieht man sehr gut, wie die drei Länder ineinander verzahnt sind, miteinander zusammenhängen, und all die grün umzeichneten Gebiete sind das die Gebiete, wo wir heute noch eine aktive Epidemie haben. Und es ist nicht eine Epidemie, die in Westafrika da ist, sondern wir haben unterschiedliche Epidemien, die dort stattfinden. Sie sehen die unterschiedlichen Kurven für Guinea, für Liberia und für Sierra Leone, die anders laufen in den unterschiedlichen Ländern. Und das hat eben auch mit den sozialen Dimensionen zu tun, die dort dahinter stehen. Für alle die heute vielleicht sich mal damit befassen möchten, ganz kurz etwas zu dem Zyklus. Ebola hat einen natürlichen Wirt. Wir gehen davon aus, dass die Flughunde und dass über die Flughunde, die das Ebola-Virus sozusagen halten können, dann andere Tiere im Regenwald infiziert werden. Und es kommt dann immer wieder, wenn gejagt wird oder in anderer Weise der Kontakt entsteht, dann zu dieser Human-to-Human-Transmission. Und im Zentrum der Übertragung stehen die Hände. Ebola fliegt nicht, es ist eine Infektion, die von Mensch zu Mensch übertragen wird, und es sind tatsächlich die Hände, die im Zentrum stehen, und deshalb ist das Händewaschen so ganz essentiell in der Prävention, und schon da beginnt es problematisch zu werden. Es hat mich traurig gemacht, immer bei meinen Besuchen, jedes Ebola Treatment Center hatte fließendes Wasser, fließendes Chlorin, alles war fließend. Und ich war im nächsten Krankenhaus und es gab kein fließendes Wasser und man musste es irgendwie anders realisieren. Da gab es viele kreative Ideen in den letzten 6 Monaten, da ist viel geleistet worden. Und ich möchte mich jetzt in der Präsentation auf die konzentrieren, die, glaube ich, am meisten auch betroffen waren. Die Gesundheitsarbeiterinnen. Und wir können Zahlen lesen, aber dahinter stehen Menschen. Wir haben gerade die Zahl gehört, 120 Ärzte in der ganzen Region. Es sind 491 Gesundheitsarbeiterinnen gestorben. Martin Salia, ich war in Kisi in diesem Krankenhaus, Chirurg, ausgebildeter Facharzt aus Sierra Leone, da um zu helfen. Der Ebola-Test kommt negativ zurück und aus lauter Freude fällt er seinem Freund um den Hals. Und es war doch positiv. Und er ist an dieser Infektion gestorben. 491 Mal. So wenig qualifiziertes Personal. Und diese Epidemie hits the heart of the system. Wir können über Systeme reden. Am Zentrum des Systems stehen Menschen, die miteinander arbeiten, die füreinander arbeiten. Und ich war in diesen Krankenhäusern und habe in diese traurigen Augen der Kolleginnen und Kollegen geschaut. Und jetzt schauen Sie sich diese Statistik an. Wenn ich die Statistik in Liberia anschaue, dann entspricht das schon mal so ein bisschen dem normalen Verhältnis. Etwa die Hälfte der Gesundheitsarbeiterinnen sind verstorben. Aber jetzt schauen Sie sich mal die Statistik für Sierra Leone an. Muss man kein Mathematiker sein. Die Mortalität ist enorm. Ich war im Foyaboma Hospital. Das Foyaboma Hospital ist an dem Dreiländereck an der Grenze von Guinea, Sierra Leone und Liberia. Foyaboma Hospital, das kann jeder, kennt jeder in der Region. Da geht man hin, weil man dort guten Service bekommt. Und am 19. März 2014 kommt diese junge Frau in dieses Krankenhaus. Durchfall, Erbrechen, sie ist dehydriert, sie hat Fieber und sie wird aufgenommen mit der Diagnose Cholera. Auch das ist ein reportable disease und das wird zum District Health Service reported. In der Folge sind 5 Mitarbeitende tot. Ich war 6 Monate später da, der Schock saß noch tief in ihren Augen. How can we continue to work? Müssen wir unser Krankenhaus schließen? Die Patienten haben es längst geschlossen, sie hatten kein Vertrauen mehr, sie sind weggeblieben. Lunza, Sierra Leone, Mabesene Hospital, da geht jeder hin. Da fährt man auch von Freetown nach Lunza, weil es dort so gute Medizin gibt. If Dr. Emmanuel died, who am I not to die? Das war die Frage, die mir x-mal gestellt wurde. Ebola hits the heart of the system. Die Menschen sind betroffen, nicht nur die Familien, es sind die Gesundheitsmitarbeitenden mitten im Zentrum. Und ich glaube, die wirklichen Heroes dieser Epidemie sind die Gesundheitsmitarbeitenden, die weitergemacht haben. Auch die, die aus Europa und Afrika gekommen sind und mit der ganzen Ausrüstung der WHO und MSF dort gearbeitet, auch das sind Heroes. Aber ich war in vielen Gesundheitseinrichtungen, die hatten alle diese Unterstützung nicht. Man hat ihnen Schutzmaterial geschickt, auch das im Lofa County, dieses Bild. Und Sie sehen, ich habe dieses Bild reingestellt, weil es zeigt die Hilflosigkeit. Die einen haben Schutzmaterial an, der eine hat Handschuhe, der andere hat keine Handschuhe. Man wusste ja gar nicht, wie sollen wir damit umgehen. Das Ganta-Hospital in Nimba County in Liberia, die Tür zum Emergency Room war einfach offen. Keine Triage, kein Schutz, kein Screening. Und wir mussten erst mal hinsitzen, mit den Mitarbeitenden reden, wie könnt ihr euch eigentlich schützen? Im September 2014 bei dem Assessment war klar, Health Workers are in Schock, traumatisiert. Es gab kein Material, es gab keine Triage, es gab keine Isolierfähigkeit. Und ganz besonders waren die Maternity Services betroffen. In Sierra Leone war ich erst in diesem Jahr, da hat man Ende letzten Jahres einfach alles zugemacht. Die Regierung hat gesagt, es ist zu gefährlich, schließt eure Kliniken, schließt eure Health Centers. Die Menschen hatten nirgend mehr, wohin zu gehen. Man hat im Dorf entbunden und wenn das nicht funktioniert hat, dann können Sie sich den Rest denken. In den Hospitälern, die ich gesehen habe bei meinem Assessment, gab es noch 5% der Deliveries von den normalen. Also 95% der Deliveries haben nicht mehr stattgefunden in Hospitälern. Dank von 2 Gesundheitszentren, die offen blieben, 76% in den Clinics und Health Facilities. And the staff, die Mitarbeitenden, interessanterweise haben die durchgehalten. Und deshalb sage ich, sie sind Heroes. Die haben durchgehalten, die haben weitergemacht. Die sind raus in die Dörfer, die haben sich eingesetzt für die Nachverfolgung, auch wenn ihre Kliniken zu waren. An einigen Kliniken haben sie viele verloren. Wir haben gemeinsam mit dem christlichen Gesundheitsnetzwerk dann dieses Programm Keep Safe, Keep Serving entwickelt. Wir haben gesagt, wir müssen die Gesundheitsmitarbeitenden in unseren Krankenhäusern sicher das so gestalten, dass sie sicher arbeiten können. Aber wir müssen auch rausgehen in die Dörfer, weil nur wenn die Menschen involviert sind, wird es auch gelingen, wirklich Kontrolle zu schaffen. Und da müssen die Referral Road, also die Verlegung von Patienten in die Behandlungszentren sicher gestalten. Und dann haben wir dieses Diagramm entwickelt. In der Community, da passiert die Infektion und da müssen wir eingreifen. Wir brauchen Menschen, die dort von Haus zu Haus gehen, die jede Familie sensibilisieren. In Sierra Leone wurden 4.000 Volunteers ausgebildet, die 160.000 Haushalte versorgt haben, 1,6 Millionen Menschen. Und dann müssen wir den Gesundheitssektor sicher gestalten. Und wir brauchen jetzt, und das wird für lange Zeit bleiben, wir brauchen im Gesundheitssektor in jedem Zentrum Isoliermöglichkeiten, weil wir in einer Region arbeiten, wo es weiterhin hämorrhagische Fieber geben wird. Deshalb Ausbildung und festlegen, wie können wir sicher arbeiten in einer Region, wo Ebola, auch wenn in Liberia heute Zero Cases sind, bleibt die Gefahr, dass wieder ein neuer Fall auftritt. Und so haben wir diese Diagramme entwickelt, wie in jedem Hospital und für jedes Health Center vorgeschaltet diese Triage ist, um dann eine grüne Zone zu kreieren, und in dieser grünen Zone kann man sicher arbeiten, aber eben auch eine Zone, in der isoliert werden kann, das ist etwas Neues, dieses ganze Thema von Hygiene, von Prävention, aber dazu brauche ich Wasser, dazu brauche ich Toiletten, dazu brauche ich Sanitation, da brauche ich Infrastruktur, um das auch umsetzen zu können, und ich glaube, da sind wir langfristig gefragt. Und so sieht das dann auch in der Realität aus. Es gibt Protokolle, wie die Triage ausgebildet wird. Es gibt Krankenhäuser, die haben inzwischen sehr, sehr intensive also Konstruktionen entwickelt. Sie sehen die Mitarbeiterin völlig abgesichert. Der Patient kommt durch und hinter einer Glasscheibe sitzen jetzt die Krankenschwestern, unterhalten sich mit den Patienten. Der junge Mann auf diesem Bild ist vom Motorrad gefallen, der hat nichts mit Ebola am Hut. Trotzdem muss er durch Screening und zwar bei jedem Verbandswechsel noch einmal, um es einfach sicher zu gehen, dass er nicht irgendwie die grüne Zone des Krankenhauses infiziert. Wir brauchen nachhaltige Lösungen für den Gesundheitssektor, wo diese Triage und die Infektionsprävention viel, viel stärker in den Vordergrund steht. Das braucht Ressourcen, das braucht Ausbildung, das braucht auch ein Umdenken in der Region. Und die Krankenschwestern und Mitarbeitenden haben ja gesagt, danke für das Training. Training und Triage haben 85% unserer Angst jetzt weggenommen. Und die 15% bleiben. Und deshalb arbeiten wir zurzeit gerade an einem speziellen Programm, auch die Traumasituation der Gesundheitsmitarbeitenden in der Region aufzunehmen und da Vorsorge zu treffen. Wie gehen wir um? Wie kann auch der Stresslevel für einen Arzt, der einen Kaiserschnitt machen muss und letzten Endes bis heute nicht 150%ig sicher sein kann, dass die Patientin nicht doch das Virus trägt? Die Maternity ist die höchste Gefahrquelle. Und dann immer wieder an jedem Zentrum, wo ich war, eine hochmotivierte Schar an Mitarbeitenden und Mitarbeitern, die gesagt haben, Leute, wir machen wieder auf, wir machen weiter, wenn ihr uns beisteht, wenn ihr mit uns unterwegs seid und das sicher gestaltet, dann machen wir den Gesundheitsservice wieder auf. Und deshalb, glaube ich, ist der große Ruf heute, Aufbau von robusten, resilienten, nachhaltigen Gesundheitssystemen. Und da geht es nicht nur um Versicherung, da geht es um sehr, sehr viel mehr. Und die muss aufbauen, nicht auf die fremden und äußeren Ressourcen, sondern aufbauend auf die lokalen Ressourcen, die vor Ort sind. Und dann müssen wir den lokalen Gesundheitsservice sicher gestalten. Wir müssen das Vertrauen, das verloren gegangen ist. Vorhin hat Ibrahim das eingedeutet, das Vertrauen zwischen Regierung und Communities ist zerstört. Das Vertrauen zwischen Gesundheitseinrichtungen und Communities ist zerstört. Die Gesundheitseinrichtung war eine Einrichtung der Heilung und heute ist sie für viele Menschen eine Einrichtung der Angst, weil sie nicht wissen, ob sie lebend wieder rauskommen. Wir müssen Research into Practice bringen, wir müssen das, was jetzt an Forschung geschieht und da passiert sehr viel, schnell in die Umsetzung bringen. Wir haben den ersten Rapid Diagnostic Test, er ist aber meines Erachtens noch nicht gut genug, aber er muss in die Umsetzung kommen und ich glaube, wir müssen Ebola Protection integrieren in einen umfassenden Ansatz der Health-Gesundheit, der Gesundheitssysteme in diesen Ländern, ob das jetzt Mutter-Kind-Systeme sind oder ob das andere Themen sind. Das muss ein integraler Bestandteil des Gesundheitssystems werden. Und wir müssen anfangen, faire Gehälter zu bezahlen. Ein Chefarzt hat zu mir gesagt, im Januar, sagte, bei mir wird nur noch der arbeiten, der nur in meinem Krankenhaus arbeitet. Und deshalb muss ich ein Gehalt bezahlen, das der nicht nebenher verdienen muss. Und das muss mir jetzt jemand ermöglichen, weil es nicht sicher ist, wenn die um 2 Uhr nach Hause gehen und dann irgendwo ihr Private Practice machen, dann besteht die Gefahr, dass über diesen Weg wieder Infektion gesteht. Deshalb paying fair wages to staff und natürlich ein gutes Regierungssystem einzuführen, Transparenz und Accountability in das ganze System einzubauen, sind ganz essentielle Punkte. Ganz herzlichen Dank.
Ja, vielen Dank an dich, Gisela. Das war, glaube ich, sehr wichtig jetzt auch für unsere Debatte, sich überhaupt mal zu versuchen, hineinzuversetzen in die Arbeitssituation der Gesundheitsarbeiterinnen vor Ort. Und jetzt werden wir zum Abschluss noch mal unseren Blick etwas weiten und uns mit den sozialen Pathologien der Ebola-Epidemie befassen. Und Dave, du hast das Wort.
Thank you. I don't really want to speak, because I think we've had so much rich information already provided that what would be really nice is a discussion about what we've heard. So I'm going to try and be very, very quick. I think I'm going to build on what the previous speakers have already said. And what I want to do is really provide a framework or an approach for looking at Ebola. Not just Ebola, the disease, but Ebola as a phenomenon. Not just the impact of Ebola, but also the way we have responded to this epidemic. So we need to look both at Ebola plus the response that we've taken to this epidemic and think critically about both of these things. Now, in providing this framework, I'm going to be talking about a lot of things and touching on many of the issues that Abu talked about. And these are things that could easily fill the time provided by a 1-year course in Masters in Global Health. So you will excuse me by making statements about things that I would ideally like to be able to describe and substantiate with facts and detail, but there won't be time. What I'm hoping is that I'll just be able to provide an idea of a kind of mindset for looking at Ebola, rather than any detailed scientific presentation. When I talk about Ebola, I mean, I normally start by talking a little bit about the disease, and Gisela has talked a little bit about it. There is a history to Ebola, it didn't come out of nowhere. And we know quite a little bit about the disease, the source of it, the mechanisms of transmission. Gisela has talked about it. There are a number of things about Ebola, which I won't go into detail here. We've covered a lot of this already. But there are a number of characteristics about this disease which make it not a particularly good candidate for an epidemic. It's true that there are no drugs or vaccines for this disease, but there are characteristics about it that would make you think when there is an outbreak, this is a disease outbreak that should be controllable. It should not spiral out of control into the kind of epidemic that we saw. So the question is, really, why did an outbreak turn into an epidemic? And why did an epidemic turn into what's been described as a global crisis? So that's really what I want to talk about. And in doing this, I think we have to try and work out where we can point our finger at the problem. What was the problem? What was the cause for an outbreak turning into an epidemic? And there has been so much written about Ebola in the international press, in the medical press, that I'm sure many of you have already begun to identify where the problem is. And once you've identified the problem, we can start to identify the solutions. We've clearly understand that this epidemic took place in three of the poorest countries in the world. Poverty is undoubtedly one of the factors that have enabled an outbreak to turn into an epidemic. We're talking about poor countries, poor people. We just heard about the importance of hand washing. These are countries where people live in peri-urban slums where there is no water, there is no clean water, there is no sanitation. It's impossible to implement basic hygiene measures. Poverty has to be something that we point the finger at. We've heard about collapsing health systems, dysfunctional health systems with no doctors, health systems with inadequate nurses, with no ambulances, with laboratories that don't work, hospitals that can't clean their bed sheets, their linen. So we must point the finger at health systems that are barely functional. And Ebola is one of these diseases where a poorly functional health system may actually be worse than no health system at all. To a large extent, the dysfunctional health systems help to accelerate the epidemic. That hospitals and clinics were in fact places at which transmission occurred. They were points of danger, not points of safety, because of the dysfunctionality of the health system. We've heard a lot about ignorance, that the people of these countries were ignorant. They didn't understand Ebola. They didn't understand disease. They couldn't understand basic, simple messages about hygiene and quarantine. There's been a lot of implicit messaging about the problem being ignorance, backwardness, culture, the burial practices being somewhat implicated as being a primary cause of this epidemic. People were not listening to the government. They were being irresponsible, not obeying measures of quarantine. Of course, we're also very good at pointing the finger at the fruit bat. That they're the ones to blame. That this is a natural problem. Somehow, it was just unfortunate that these troublesome animals carry diseases that affect us as humans. Linked to this has been a lot of finger pointing at local communities who have been accused of causing deforestation and creating a local environment that enables diseases to spill over from the animal world to the human world. We've heard lots being said about the failed state of these three countries. It's a problem of bad governments, failed governments. And we've had lots of fingers being pointed at WHO. WHO failed. WHO itself is dysfunctional. And that there's a problem of governance, both at the country level but also at the global level, that this was a failure of global health governance. So I think if you read how this Ebola crisis is described in the newspapers, these are the kinds of causes that are often talked about, you know, what caused this crisis. But I think we should interrogate some of these causes. Let's look at poverty. Is poverty really the problem in these three countries that are so rich with timber, oil, diamonds? These are rich countries, they're not poor countries. So why is poverty a problem? What about health systems? I thought we were living in a golden age of global health. The last 20 years has seen a fivefold increase in the amount of development assistance for health. Why do we have collapsed health systems in these three countries? The Gates Foundation, Gavi, the Global Fund, international aid agencies have all been working in these three countries for decades. Why do we have collapsed health systems? The failed state of these three countries. Yes, there are failures in democracy. There are failures in governance. But why? Why are these failures tolerated? Why do they exist? These are not natural phenomena. WHO failed. Yes, WHO failed. But why? We've known about the failures of WHO for decades. There is a mountain of literature describing the dysfunctionalities of WHO, the problems of WHO, the financial, administrative, and managerial problems that exist within the organization. This is not new. We shouldn't be surprised to recognize that WHO took a long time to respond to this epidemic, and it failed to gather an adequate international response to the epidemic when it first emerged. Creating a functional WHO is not impossible. It is not a problem without solutions. There are many solutions to the problems of WHO, just as there are many solutions to the problems of poor governance in these three countries. We need to understand why these solutions are not being implemented. What about ignorance and backwardness? Is this actually true? Are we really saying that the people in these three countries are incapable of learning basic messages about hygiene and about how to control transmission? Of course not. Are we really saying that cultural practices can't be changed by the people once they understand the nature of this disease? Of course not. What was really underlying the problem was a lack of trust, which is what Abu talked about, a lack of trust that has good foundations. There are reasons why there's a lack of trust. Look at the history of these three countries and look at the rampant exploitation that goes on in these three countries. Why should they trust? Why should people trust anyone in authority? Did we actually make this epidemic worse by this authoritarian approach to dealing with the epidemic? By neglecting the community, by seeing the community as a problem rather than seeing the community as part of the solution? Part of the response to this epidemic was to marginalize and stigmatize the community, who should have been seen as partners in the solution. And this was done not just by the government, but to a large extent as well by external agencies. I remember reading in the newspapers in England about how the UK Army, the British Army, was being sent to Sierra Leone to save the people of Sierra Leone. We were sending the army to deal with this epidemic. And I was trying to understand, why do we need to send the army? And I read the article and I thought, oh, okay, they've explained why. We need to send the army because the army can build hospitals and can build treatment centers. And I thought, okay, there's at least a good reason. Because I suddenly realized that there are no carpenters in Sierra Leone, that there are no work people in Sierra Leone, that clearly the people in Sierra Leone are incapable of building treatment centers and structures. So what are really the neglected pathologies? I mean, I've really alluded to them, that our response to this epidemic has been problematic. The way in which we shape and understand this epidemic, I think, has been problematic as well. What we don't talk about are the kind of is the big picture, the big picture context of this epidemic, the exploitation. As I said earlier, you know, these are rich countries. Liberia has had the highest amount of foreign direct investment as a proportion of GDP of any country in the world. These are three countries that really need to be understood using the word neocolonial. Three countries that are really exploited, whose resources are extracted, whose wealth is taken out of the country, whose people are being underdeveloped, actively kept underdeveloped. These are three countries that really suffer under the broad framework of neoliberal globalization. Economic models of development that are enshrined in the World Trade Organization, that are enshrined in the IMF, in World Bank programs for the many past decades, in trade and investment agreements, that are simply not working. Not working in terms of poverty alleviation, not working in terms of climate change and the environment. They're certainly not working in terms of reducing socioeconomic inequality, which gets worse. We need to be thinking in terms of oppression, not in terms of ignorance. That the kind of people that Abu represents, people who are striving to create a state that isn't failing, striving for democracy, for transparency, for justice. It's not that there aren't enough people like that in these countries. It's the fact that these people are being oppressed. So we need to understand how that oppression works. How is it that power is able to oppress the majority of people? Instead of looking at poverty, perhaps we need to be looking at wealth and power as being the problem. I think we need to be thinking about neglect. We've talked about that, but I think we need to also be talking about arrogance here. And this is the arrogance that I think is pervasive in the global health community. There is the feeling in the global health community that we can bypass political problems by the use of technology and science, that we can bypass social problems by the adoption of vertical programs to save people rather than to provide them with the conditions under which they can develop themselves. That we can address these problems through charity and we can ignore justice. We also need to be aware of how crises can be used opportunistically by people who seek to benefit from them. And it's worthwhile, I think, understanding how this crisis has also been used to benefit certain sectors within society. The security sector, for example, has benefited from the way in which this epidemic has been characterized as a security problem. Billions of dollars have been spent to strengthen the security apparatus to keep out the diseased and the poor from the areas in which the rich and the wealthy inhabit. So I'm going to stop there and leave you with this question. What is needed? Do we need more research? Do we need more analysis? Do we need more understanding of what happened? Do we need more reform of governance? Do we need more calls for health system strengthening? I mean, we've had all this. I think we need more than just that. So that's what I think we should be discussing, and I hope you'll have some ideas about what we can do with this question. Thank you.